Hi, it's Radhika Jones, editor-in-chief of Vanity Fair. If you enjoy binge-watching the best TV shows and love hearing from the actors and showrunners who make them happen, then subscribe to Vanity Fair. Our Hollywood reporters take you behind the scenes of the year's most anticipated projects, the industry's biggest moves, and the hardest-fought awards races. From The Crown to The Real Housewives, we've got the inside scoop. As a special thank you to our still-watching audience, we're offering 15% off a yearly digital subscription to Vanity Fair. Visit vanityfair.com today and use promo code POD15. That's vanityfair.com, promo code POD15 for 15% off a yearly digital subscription to everything you want.
Hear my words and bear witness to my vow. Night gathers and now my watch begins. It shall not end until my death. I shall take no wife, hold no lands, father no children. I shall wear no crowns and win no glory. I shall live and die at my post. I am the sword in the darkness. I am the watcher on the walls. I am the shield that guards the realm of men. I pledge my life and honor to the Night's Watch. For this night, and all the nights to come.
Hello and welcome to the last episode of Still Watching Game of Thrones. I'm Vanity Fair senior writer Joanna Robinson. Joining me for the last time on this series of this podcast is the lovely Katie Rich. Hello, Katie Rich.
Am I being exiled north of the wall? Is this the end of me?
We're sending you to the Isle of Noth. I regret to inform
it
you.
It sounds great there, although it's now full of angry Unsullied, so maybe I'll stay away.
Well, there's also cannibal butterflies there, but we can talk about that later.
No one told me that.
Yeah. They never tell you that in the brochure. Anyway. This is not the end of the Still Watching podcast. Obviously, we will be back in a couple weeks to talk about the next big HBO prestige series, which is Big Little Lies. Rich will be back from Cannes. We're all going to Monterey, but this is the last time we will be talking about Westeros.
Oh, it's so crazy. I know this isn't the last time you'll be talking about Westeros. You have like other Game of Thrones podcasts to wrap up. But like when you said that, I literally got chills. Like, holy cow, it's over.
It's over. Well, until the books come out, right?
Will the books come out?
Will they? We are here to talk about specifically season 8, episode 6, called The Iron Throne, written by D.B. Weiss and David Benioff, directed by D.B. Weiss and David Benioff. But also we're here to talk about all of Thrones ever as well. First, Katie and I have to get through some awards and some discussion of this final chapter. All right. So when we were doing our rewatch podcast, I would do a 15-word recap of the episode of Game of Thrones. I just thought I would honor that this week and say,
wow,
15 words or less. And I'm just going to go with less or fewer, whatever Stannis would say. And I got to go, just the end, right? It's the end.
Yeah.
Here we
it's
go.
It's over.
All right. So let us kick off with our awards. We start with our sort of obvious MVP of the episode. Katie Rich, who is your obvious MVP of the Iron Throne?
I am as surprised as anyone to be saying this, but Kit Harington. I thought he stepped up his acting so much in this episode. Like, he's got all of these super crucial scenes, and the first half of the episode is entirely reliant on watching him coming around to making this big decision that is important and he knows he has to do and Tyrion is telling him to do. And I thought he played that indecision really well. And like Jon Snow failing to make a decision is a running theme of Game of Thrones, but it felt really powerful this time around. And then him going north of the wall and being with Tormund. And like, I mean, I think his face isn't the last shot, but it's close to the last shot. And like watching the mix of feelings of him returning north of the wall, I was really impressed by him and in his scenes with Emilia Clarke, which we'll obviously get into.
Yeah, it's interesting because I think one of the criticisms of these final seasons has been people feeling that Game of Thrones did not really land the Jon Daenerys romance and that they needed to really land that romance to make this choice feel so painful. And while I agree that I don't, you know, the Emilia Clarke Kit Harington friendship, obvious friendship, has not translated to on-screen fireworks for me, the indecision, it's sort of like last week when I was like, I don't know what Emilia Clarke is playing on the back of that dragon, but she's playing it really well. Like, I don't necessarily buy that Jon Snow loves Daenerys, but whatever it is that he's feeling conflicted about, Kit Harington is delivering that conflict for me. Do you know?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. All right. So my obvious MVP, I'm going to go meta. You can pick, you know, you can pick an actor, you can pick a character. I'm going to, like, grudgingly, I have to, at the end of this all, give it to Sansa Stark, who got her independent North, got to be Queen of the North, got her brother on the Iron Throne, and her other brother is, like, the leader of everything north of the Wall. So, like, the Stark family has it all stitched up from top to bottom in Westeros. So, you know, in terms of who played the game and played it well, because Bran's not playing the game. Bran's, like, galactic braining this, you know, like, you can't say that Bran's playing. But as far as Sansa playing the game, like, she played it, she won, she got what she wanted.
Do you assume Sansa's the reason that there were three Starks on that council getting three votes for no reason?
I was really irritated by that. I mean, looking at the I don't think they all voted. Sansa voted representing the North, and Arya and Bran just sort of like
sat there. That's true. They got to be there. Well, like, I don't also don't know why Bran was there.
Yeah. I mean, at least they had Davos at the line of, like, not sure we get a vote, but everyone's like, just like, okay, I'll vote.
I'm here because I survived the series? Okay.
Yeah. Well, I did like that, you know, that they had some people sitting in that council that weren't people we knew. So it wasn't just like, okay, all the characters, all the actors who survived the series get to decide who the king of Westeros is.
Yeah. Well, I was grateful for your post because I always assume that if there's characters who I don't recognize in the scene, I just have forgotten about them. And I was grateful that you were like, oh yeah, we're not supposed to know who that dude is.
Yeah, I have a post up on VF.com right now that's just like a breakdown of who was on that great council because there were some fun faces. Edmure Tully gets up and gives a speech. I love that Tobias Menzies came back for that. I thought he did a great job with it. Robin Aaron was there, young Robin Aaron, Jon Royce, obviously a Dornish prince, as we mentioned. But yeah, there were a bunch of little beardos there who were not supposed to know who they are. And it, like, and I, on the one hand, I like that. On the other hand, they could have really tossed, if they wanted to, the book readers like a bone and stamped a sigil on any one of those like breastplates or something like that. So we can be like, ooh,
that's
House Dairy representing or like whatever, you know, it would have been fun for us, but that's okay. Yeah. So you can, if you're still confused as to who was on in that great council meeting, go check it out. All right. Let us switch over to our stealth MVPs or sneaky MVPs of the episode. Katie, who do you have?
It's Archmaester Ebros, aka the Jim Broadman character who wrote the Song of Ice and Fire, which I had to kind of go back and catch it because I just saw Sam put down this giant book and I was like, oh, he wrote the book because he's George R. R. Martin. But it's more complicated than that. But I wish Jim Broadman had gotten to come back. But the fact that he wrote everything down and left Tyrion out is perfect.
Yeah, this is this is one of those things that people, like one of those seeds they planted in season 7 that I think a lot of people felt had to pay off in season 8 when Jim Broadbent's character says to Sam, like, I'm working on this history of Westeros, and he like rattles off this long title and Sam gives a sort of like wincing look and he's like, what, you don't like the title? You know, and I'm just like, obviously that is going to be called A Song of Ice and Fire. But I think some people did expect that, like Frodo or Bilbo in Lord of the Rings, that Sam would be the one to at least like finish it or something like that. But no, he's the book delivery boy instead. So that's a fine job to have.
Yeah.
My sneaky MVP, I don't know how sneaky it is, but I have to give it to Michelle Clapton, the costume designer on the show.
Man.
We will talk a little bit more about this later, but like the point is Michelle always delivers the good looks, has delivered amazing looks for 8 seasons. There was a season that she took most of off and you can tell, but like has delivered so many amazing looks and you're just sort of like, she didn't need to in this final episode. Mm-hmm. There's a lot going on. She didn't need to, like, they didn't have to give us just, like, such a fashion moment, but they did, which, like I said, we're going to talk about. But, you know, shout out to Michelle Clapton. She, like, sort of, she dressed a new era of king in King's Landing. She gave Daenerys a final sort of, like, black leather stormtrooper evil, like, look at the end. Like, all of it is an amazing situation. So, Michelle Clapton.
Yeah, all right. She has deserved all of the credit she's gotten for the show and more.
Every single Emmy ever. Yeah. It's just amazing what she's created. And, like, something I love about what she's created is, as we were talking about that Great Council thing, I mean, I just like that you're like, oh, there's the Dorne guy. I mean, sure, mm-hmm. their look is very different from everyone else. But at the same time, I could say there's that Dorne guy. And I was like, oh, that guy's from the north. I can tell because his cloak is, like, crisscrossed this way. You know, like, there are some, like, signs of where people are from based on what Michelle Clapton has created for them. Which is
and
cool.
And a shout out to Bran, who gets this great look when he actually becomes king. Like, I'm looking at the photos now of them saying goodbye to Jon. And it's, like, this, like, rich black fabric, but it looks kind of northish. It has, like, a fur vibe to it, and Tyrion's echoing it in his clothes. Like, it made me wonder, like, who is there, like, stitching together clothes for everybody in this newly rebuilding society where no one in King's Landing is left alive, but they put the work in.
I've had those thoughts all along, like, who was the seamstress that Daenerys took with her to Winterfell who made her all those amazing, like, winter coats?
Oh yeah, who's braiding her hair?
Yeah. Who are these, like, humble workers of Westeros? All right. This is where we are going to do, I don't know if you're actually gonna do this for me, Katie, but a dramatic line reading of one of your favorite lines from the episode.
I feel like you would be doing it such an injustice because what is so great about it is the performance of it. But I'll do my best. It is, no, Your Grace, I don't want it. I don't deserve it. I thought I was wise, but I wasn't. I thought I knew what was right, but I didn't. Tyrion, Peter Dinklage killed it throughout this whole episode, but I just love the moment of him reckoning with his past mistakes when Bran asked him to be his hand, and kind of getting it anyway. And it made me think of a show that I know you're thinking about a lot right now, Lost, and the way that it deals with Ben Linus in the finale. And you've got someone who's made all these horrible mistakes and is kind of allowed to think about it, but is not rejected for it. And I really like that ending for Tyrion, like his surprise winding up at that small council table, and kind of recognizing that this is where his life has taken him. And that moment, and the way that moment is shot where the camera's kind of moving around him. I love that scene.
Yeah, it's interesting because for a peek behind the curtain, I like when I saw the wind going this way that like Tyrion might wind up with a happier ending, I was like working on a post for VF.com of like, do we think Tyrion deserves a happy ending after all of the mistakes he's made? Mm-hmm. He's just made mistake after mistake after mistake. And it was frustrating me that Daenerys was being pitched as this unreasonable, you know, tyrant when a lot of her misfortune came from listening to Tyrion give her terrible advice. And she followed his advice. And it screwed her over. Like, Tyrion's big mistake wasn't supporting Daenerys in the first place. Maybe it was. But, like, he also just, like, really led her down the wrong path because of his loyalty to his family and all sorts of stuff. So, like, I was like, Tyrion has done so many awful things. And he rattles them all off. Like, you know, he chokes. I was glad that they mentioned Shay. I feel like we always forget that Tyrion murdered Shay, all this stuff. And so then they made that scene about Bran giving him, like, yes, kind of something he's always wanted, which is to be Hand of the King, but also a punishment. Like, you're going to have to live with your crimes. You're going to have to make up for your crimes, sort of thing. And so I was like, oh, I just, like, threw that post out the window. I was like, never mind. They addressed that for me.
So remind me, this is, like, my, like, Game of Thrones Civ memory. Has he been Hand in King's Landing before? I know he was Daenerys' Hand, but has he ever had that role before?
Yeah, he was Joffrey's Hand.
Okay, that's what I thought. So he's been in this place before, but not under these circumstances.
Yeah, and I think for years, like, before Tyrion went, like, really dark and before Tyrion started making, like, tactical mistake after tactical mistake, I always thought my ideal ending to Game of Thrones would be, like, some sort of benign monarch with a Tyrion, like, chaser, you know, with a Tyrion as a hand. Like, you need Tyrion as a hand. He has that political mind. Like, he knows when morality should be bent for the greater good, sort of thing. Mm-hmm. And then he just like went so far off the path of being a good political advisor that I was like, never mind, get this guy away from any administration. I don't want him. But here we are at the end of it all. But yeah, he was hand to Joffrey and in season two. And he was good, but obstructed at every turn by Joffrey's awfulness and also Cersei's plotting. So
yes. All right. So I think it's going to turn out better this time.
Here's Tyrion unfettered. All right. My dramatic line reading means I get to do an impression of like my favorite character to do an impression of at the end of Game of Thrones, which is, why do you think I came all this way? that's King Bran the Broken, or Creepy King Bran, whatever you want to call him. But apparently he knew this was coming. You know, once he says that, if you go back and rewatch, I think it is episode 2 of the season. It might even be episode 1. There's a shot where Tyrion is in the courtyard of Winterfell. And Bran is down at the like bottom of the courtyard, and Tyrion's sort of like up on one of the like walkways, and they share this look. And it's just a weird, significant look. Like Bran's looking at him, and like those of us who are watching closely were like, okay, something. Bran sees something.
Yeah.
With Tyrion. We don't know what it is. So in theory, maybe it was the destruction of King's Landing. Or maybe it was this.
So do we think that Bran has known that this would happen since he became the Three-Eyed Raven? Is that how those powers work?
The way that Bran's powers work, he can see the future. That is an ongoing debate in the fandom. But I have had confirmation from people who work on the show that Bran can indeed see the future. But what's murky about his powers and what is narratively convenient about his powers is that he can't always decipher what he can see.
Yeah.
He can't understand what he can see, or he, like, just because he can see everything doesn't mean he's always like looking at everything, if that makes sense. So like he has access to all the information. He's just not always looking at it. So
got it.
What did Bran know, and when did he know it about when he would become king? I'm sure Isaac Hempstead Wright knows, but I'm not sure it's clear from the show. I would say it's clear from maybe that shot he shares with Tyrion. And then there's like Tyrion's interest in Bran is a running theme of the season. There's a scene right before the Battle of Winterfell in episode 2 when Tyrion just like tucks up with Bran, is like, tell me everything you know. I'm just curious. That's right. You know? So like this has been slightly planted, but not in any sort of really deeply rooted way.
Sure.
All right. This is where Katie and I could not possibly choose two different winners for this award. It is the Best Dress Award. Katie, I will let you announce the obvious person that we picked for this award.
All hail Sansa, Queen of the North. Man, her outfit rules. She like shows up in the throne room. She's got like these leaves stitched into it, which I guess are the weirwood
leaves.
Yeah,
the weirwood leaves.
Yeah, you have paid more attention to costuming on this show to know what makes this gown so spectacular.
Well, yeah, I mean, I think the gray of it, which is not, you know, we've been seeing Sansa in a lot of dark ever since she sort of fell under Littlefinger's thumb. She opted for a lot of black, some like other things, but like this gray, which looks like such a stark gray to me, House Stark gray, this like wolfy color. I mean, like this is a wolf gown. Like she's wearing this wolf gown. She's got the weirwood leaves stitched in there. That's been a running thing for Sansa, is like, you don't have to ask who made Sansa's clothes, because it's usually Sansa. You know, she has made her own clothes throughout the series. She was constantly doing this, like, you know, we saw her in the very first episode stitching. She's constantly doing these, like, embroidery things. So the fact that it has this, like, meaning, something that is significant to House Stark, these weirwood leaves, stitched onto this beautiful sort of wolfy gown. And then she's got this incredible, like, wolf crown.
Oh my god, the crown is so good.
Yeah, so she looks amazing. There's this discussion going on last night based on a tweet that went viral, and I want to say it was Anthony Olivares, but please let me know if I got that wrong. But he was pointing out, and once again, I have not checked this because I do not have an English history degree, but apparently, you know, Queen Elizabeth was crowned with her hair down. This I know from Kate Blanchett films. Mm-hmm. And that was like non-traditional, and she did it in order to reclaim her sexuality. We have no precedence in Game of Thrones for women being crowned with their hair up. Cersei's the only other queen we've seen crowned, and she, you know, she had that, like, jaunty page boy. So, like, I don't know if Sansa getting crowned with her hair down is any sort of in defiance of something in Westeros.
Mm-hmm. But, it looks great, though.
It looks great.
Sansa's hair is a great asset, always.
Well, she's, you know, she's a redhead. So, like, any sort of, you know, I will not get in the way of any sort of, like, this is evoking Queen Elizabeth somehow. Totally. You know what I mean? Like, sure. Why not? Great. Okay.
Question that I feel like I should know the answer to. Are Sansa and Tyrion still married, technically?
I don't know that we know the answer to that. Because she got married to Ramsay after him. They never got, like, an official annulment. Annulments do exist in Westeros. I mean, I think it's just, like, messy.
And I mean, I guess, like, they could still be legally married, but who cares?
Yeah, I think that's the case. They're still legally married, but who cares?
I'm Claire Fallon.
And I'm Emma Gray. We're culture writers, podcasters, and hosts of the show Love to See It.
Every week, we give an unapologetically feminist dissection of reality dating shows, rom-coms, and other romance narratives. We unpack all the weird messages they send us about love, sex, and dating.
And we dive into all the details with special guests like actors, authors, and cultural critics.
You can find Love to See It wherever you get your podcasts. New episodes drop every Tuesday.
Hi, I'm Lale Arakoglu, host of Women Who Travel. Each story from our guests and listeners is totally unique and utterly personal. We love hearing about your first impressions when visiting someplace new.
My first trip to the Patagonia region was on the Argentine side. I couldn't believe the expansive territory. It's like being in Tibet. The emptiness and the harshness really, I found transformative.
Or a story told when safely back on dry land.
You know, things happened every single day. I ran out of gas on a jet ski in the middle of the ocean. And I was like, what if a sea creature comes to eat me? But then I'm delusional. I was like, I'll make friends with it and it won't eat me. And maybe I'll ride that back to shore.
That's how it works.
Yeah. Join me, Lale Arakoglu, every week for more adventures on Women Who Travel, wherever you listen to your podcasts.
All right, and then last but not least, our ship of the episode, two characters or like two inanimate objects or whatever that we are rooting for to get together. Kitty Rich, who is your ship of the final episodes of Game of Thrones?
I'm trying to do what I think Richard would do if he were here, and I, as far as I know, he hasn't even watched the episode yet, but I feel like Robin Arryn and the Prince of Dorne both showed up to that meeting looking great. They both look young. They got lands to rule. Let them team up and, you know, create a new alliance.
Yeah, our producer of this podcast, Dave Gonzalez, has been a fan of Robin Arryn, just like a joking fan of Robin Arryn.
Yes.
For years. And so when he showed up, like, looking so good, and like, with that sort of, like, loche sort of princely.
Oh, he had, like, a real Timothy Chalamet vibe.
Yeah. He was just sort of slouching, legs crossed out in front of him sort of thing. And it was just like, yeah, it was really good. All right. Well, I'm going to ship. Okay. Here's my, like, fan fiction of the future of Westeros under King Bran. Because there are, like, some happy endings here for a lot of our favorites, blah, blah, and Bran of Tarth gets to be the Lord Commander of the Kingsguard, which is a huge deal.
Yeah.
She went from, like, first female knight in all of Westeros to, like, Lord Commander. What a glow up. So that's great for Brienne, and she knighted Pod, so he's Sir Pod. He's also in the Kingsguard, so, like, here are our, you know, valiant, heroic people holding, like, wearing that shiny gold armor that is, like, I think it's the first time I've ever seen the Kingsguard armor look like it, you know, belongs on the people that are wearing it. Mm-hmm. So that's all great. Here's an issue I have. If you're in the Kingsguard, you know, you're supposed to kind of take a vow of chastity is part of the Kingsguard. And I don't know that I like that for either Brienne or Pod. So,
well, how
I'm
seriously
just gonna,
have vows of chastity been taken on this show, though?
I mean, you can't get, well, here's what I'm saying. For the future, for Bran Stark's administration as king, I think he's going to be like, you know what? Vows of chastity are so, you know, Rhaenyra Baratheon or Rhaenyra Targaryen or whatever. Like, because Sam's a maester, and I'm sure maesters aren't supposed to have wives, but, like, you know, he's not breaking up with Gilly. So, like, yeah. Sam gets to be a maester and keep Gilly and Sam, little Sam, and the other baby on the way, right? Mm-hmm. These Bran and Pod get to be in the Kingsguard, but also get to, like, pursue whatever they want romantically. And heck, Jon Snow, you're in the Night's Watch, but, like, it's okay. Eventually you'll get over your two girlfriends ever in your life dying in your arms and move on to someone else. So I'm just saying, like, I ship the end of Vows of Chastity in Game of Thrones.
That is a great idea. Do you feel like you have an ideal match for Pod or Brienne? I was just thinking, like, should they get together? It's like, nah, that's not the relationship. But I don't know who. I mean, I guess there's other people left in King's Landing.
A few, I suppose. I just want Pod with, like, a really nice girl. Like, for a while, I was shipping Pod and Sansa as sort of like a, he would just be so nice to her, you know? And then she, I think, would be nice to him in turn. And it would just be like, you know, Sansa could be like, austere and badass and ruling in the ways that she likes to be with everyone else. And then with Pod, she could just be like, you know,
chill,
let her hair down. That was one thing. Or just, you know, Sansa doesn't need a boyfriend. She can do whatever she wants. I don't know. I've no one specific in mind. I just want everyone to, like, live their full lives.
You want everyone to have love.
You can have a career and a romance, is what I'm saying.
You can be Queen of the North and have a romance.
Yeah, I didn't like the idea of Brienne of Tarth. Like, Brienne of Tarth gets, like, ultimate career goals, but, like, I want her to have the whole package is my point. So. Yeah. There we go. All right. So let us talk about a little bit more about the episode as a whole. I think you and I both liked it better than maybe some folks did. I certainly liked it much better than, I'd say, the previous three episodes.
Yeah.
I had a hard time with 3, 4, and 5, and I liked 6 a lot better.
I feel like I have this, like, when a show ends that I like and I care about and I just get to see how the characters wind up. And I think this show revealed a soft spot for its characters that maybe some of us thought it might not have, kind of going into the Battle of Winterfell expecting everyone to die. It's just like, you know, getting to see Arya, like, embark on a new adventure and seeing Jon's, like, kind of joy at being back in the North. Like, I like that it took care of everybody. And, like, obviously not everybody. There's, like, various dangling plot threads. But I know a lot of people were, like, hoping to see the return of magic or see something, like, dealing with, like, various, like, crazy world-building things. But I thought focusing on the characters and wrapping them up and putting them where they belonged was the right thing to do.
Yeah. No, I mean, George R. R. Martin has said for a very long time that his plan for the ending of Game of Thrones is bittersweet. The only argument I might make about this finale is that you have, like, it goes hard on the bitter for, like, 20 minutes. And then it's, like, or maybe 30 minutes. I don't know. However long it takes for Jon Snow to kill Daenerys and Drogon to build the throne. And then it's just, like, hitting you really hard with the sweet. You know what I mean? And so it doesn't feel, like, modulated. It's just, like, a hard swing in tone. Like, I think, and I felt that the most, you know, you've got this time jump, basically, that happens, right?
Yeah, it's so like Tyrion, a couple weeks that Tyrion's in there, right?
Yeah, Tyrion and Jon have time to grow their beers in jail. And Tyrion rolls up to this great council meeting, and immediately they bring Edmure in for, like, immediate comic relief. And you're like, ah, we're in a different phase of the show now.
I felt good because it's been so long since there could be any genuine comic relief because the stakes of the season have been so high.
Yeah, I think that's fair. I think it's fair. Something that I didn't like, two things that I didn't like. One is that I feel like Grey Worm is stuck in, like, sort of a villain role through the rest. Mm-hmm. I mean, he gets his, like, I'm going to the Isle of Noth to hang out with the cannibal butterflies ending. So he's not like, I'm going to go, you know, perpetrate more war elsewhere in the world. He's retiring,
yeah,
in theory. Or they're about to make Noth a terrible place. I don't know. But, like, I just didn't like Grey Worm being our, like, main antagonist in that great council meeting. Yara got to do some a little antagonizing too. You know, she's still loyal to Daenerys. But yeah, I just didn't like that for Grey Worm and his
all of
mode.
The logic of like how all of that came together where like Grey Worm's like, we need justice, and then it's like Tyrion's like, I have an idea. He's like, all right, fine, I guess I just have to let you decide what's gonna happen. It was Grey Worm didn't seem to be the one who had all the power here, but he has all the big armies. Like, I don't really know how the like balance of power worked out well in that time jump. So I think you're right that like, you know, Grey Worm turning full vengeance villain after Missandei's death, like, it goes along with Daenerys, and like, he's the only one. But when she's gone, like, he's kind of stuck in this position of the enforcer.
Yeah, and maybe I wish, you know, Jacob Anderson has been so great, so I'm not faulting his performance, but maybe I wish I could have seen a little bit more of that mode maybe sitting uncomfortably with him, so that maybe then when Tyrion's like, we can just elect a new king, maybe Grey Worm is relieved because he's like, I don't want to like,
yeah,
be like, if in charge him, of the city and this army,
like,
you know?
When he's executing those Lannister soldiers in the beginning, like not just seeing it be pure like vengeance.
Right. Exactly. All right. And then the other thing I don't like about this happy ending is that Bronn, who has done nothing to deserve anything, is the Lord of Highgarden, which really bothers me. Master of Coin, I don't mind too much because I feel like you need to have someone like awful in the role of Master of Coin. This is the Littlefinger role.
Okay. Okay.
Tyrion was Master of Coin for a while, but like, I feel like Bronn is a good thing to have on maybe on that small council in that he's very likely to fuck a lot of things up. And I think you don't need that council to be like all the perfect paragons of virtue on the council.
Sure.
And so like, is Bronn going to plunge them all into like mass amounts of debt to the Iron Bank? Probably. You know what I mean? Like, that's probably something Bronn's going to do. So I'm not that mad about him being Master of Coin. I am mad about him having Lady Olenna's castle. Like, that bothers me. Like, get out of the Tyrell family home, please. So my fan fiction thought of this, and I don't know that I'm the one that came up with it, but it's something that I was joking with some friends, is that Olenna and Margaery, the ghosts of Olenna and Margaery, just like bedevil Bronn in his castle for the rest of his life.
Oh, that would be so satisfying.
Yeah. Yeah. So they just like fuck with him.
I like the small council vibe. I like that there's Bronn to kind of like needle everybody. I love, obviously, Master of Grammar as Davos picks up Stannis's habit of correcting other people's grammar. But I did expect it to end on more of a note of like, the cycle is going to perpetuate. Like, Bran will be a good king. They're going to pick another one. Like, they kind of have pseudo-democracy. But I thought there was going to be more of a sense of, like, the story ever turning onwards. Like, not just a pure, okay, this is totally working out perfectly for everybody feeling about it.
Yeah, that's a – I think that's a good point. I think if it were Martin's – like a little bit more of a George R. R. Martin version of the ending, there might be more hints of like same as it ever was.
Yeah.
Whereas this seems to be selling, no, we really did break the wheel.
And, yeah. That was kind of what I was surprised by. Like, and I think like the idea that like, you know, in 10 years, they'll like, not 10 years, so whenever Bran dies, they'll get together and like, I'll choose a new king and it won't just be like automatically someone else. But like, that's probably not. I don't give pseudo democracy in Westeros very long before war starts again, basically.
Yeah, I mean, like it was bananas that Sansa and this great council is just like, yeah, but I'm gonna be independent, okay?
Uh huh.
Okay, cool. I mean, like, why didn't Dorne just be like, hey, we were independent for a really long time, so we would like to be so too. Like,
yeah.
Dorne has a very long history of being independent from the Seven Kingdoms, and so the fact that like they didn't speak up or anything, you know, the Iron Islands are independent, so like Yara, you know, gets to stay on her island, and that's fine. But like,
so why does Yara get a vote then if she's independent?
I mean, it's a great question. But yeah, so now and with the North gone, it's the Six Kingdoms, which is you know, it's funny to think about. But yeah, this is a real power grab from the Stark family.
I know,
it's like nuts to me that they let all of this happen, like, you know, with the Starks having so much power, even though Arya has left Westeros. I was very grateful that I was right that I didn't know what was going to – I was pretty sure Daenerys was going to die in this episode. I didn't know how, and I didn't know if it was going to be Jon or Arya, mm-hmm. and like Arya for Jon sort of thing. And I felt like it should be Jon because the whole like – he who passes sentence swings a sword sort of thing.
Yeah.
But I was worried it was going to be Arya. And so many people seemed convinced it was Arya. But, like, I felt like the whole lesson that Arya learned in the Bells from Sandor was don't be a murderer.
Yeah.
And so I was like, I can't have Arya come back in the next episode and be a murderer, even if it is, like, the right thing to do for the realm. Like, I need her to have just learned that lesson. And so I was really happy to see her on the ship. She got a, like, you know, jaunty adventuring new hairstyle.
Yeah, I was so happy about that.
Yeah, and it evokes the end of season 4, The Children, which is a really good episode of Game of Thrones, the season 4 finale, when Arya left for Essos, for Braavos in the first place. Mm-hmm. It ends with that, like, same choral version of the theme, which we hear in this episode, and Arya on a ship going off. And so they mimicked that for her. And that was a really hopeful, positive ending that I could really fully get behind. Like, Arya has put the traumatic way in which she was dealing with the events of the season behind her, but she's not going to be, like, you know, Lady of Storm's End or whatever. She's off. She's going off adventuring. It's just not murder adventuring, and that's great. You know what I mean? So,
yeah. How do you feel about a somewhat similar ending for Jon?
Once again, it may be almost too much of a happy ending for Jon, because, like, Kit, as you said, Kit Harington was really selling that conflict. And, like, this is a plea, you know, he's separated maybe forever from his sisters, unless Queen Sansa decides to visit the Wall. She'll visit the Wall.
Yeah, come on.
You know, he's separated from, you know, all of his friends, except for Tormund and Ghost. Like, there's some poignancy there. But the North is where he's always been truly happiest. And there is this smile on his face that he has when he, like, sort of hits the road. And I guess it reminds me of, and forgive me, I can't think of the author, but there was a piece a couple weeks ago, I want to say it was on Slate, but I could be wrong, that was about sort of like redemption is a reality in Westeros for the male characters. And so, like, Tyrion gets a chance to, like, atone for his mistakes, and Jon gets a chance to, like, atone for his crime. Daenerys, admittedly, her crimes are more severe, but, like, you know, this idea that, like, I think the piece was originally written for about Jaime, and I don't know if it really sticks because Jaime's redemption arc was slippery and he backslid and all this sort of stuff, but it felt like the Jaime journey of, like, I can push kids out of a window and still be a hero.
Or Tyrion. Like, Tyrion. Doing all those bad things and then getting Hand of the King.
Right. And so, like, I mean, I think you see in the Jon and Daenerys sort of final throne room scene, he's trying desperately to give her an out. You know what I mean? Like, he's trying to get an answer for her that would mean he didn't have to kill her.
Uh-huh.
And she can't give him that answer.
Yeah.
And so, you know, that's all there. It's like, if she had wanted redemption, if she had had remorse in that moment, I think there would have been an avenue of redemption for her. But once again, it's just like, you know, the gendered nature of this ending is sort of impossible to ignore. We have Queen Sansa, but at the same time, you know, I don't know if you saw that Entertainment Weekly had, you know, sort of these wide-ranging interviews with Emilia Clarke and Kit Harington about how they felt about the ending. And Kit Harington, like, one of these interviews took place in a tent in Belfast while they're, like, filming it. And Kit Harington was, like, so scared that everyone would think this is just the most sexist ending of Game of Thrones. And Game of Thrones is already a show that sort of grappled with this perception of gender issues. And so Kit Harington's like, okay, I get to kill Daenerys, who is this symbol of, like, female strength for a lot of people. Like, that sits really poorly with me.
Yeah.
You know? So, like,
he saw it coming.
Yeah.
How definitely. Do you, so I, oh, sorry, go finish your thought.
No. I mean, like, kind of how could you not? And so then in order to do it anyway is either an act of bravery or something else, willful blinders up for, you know, what the current climate is. I don't know. What were you going to say?
I think I have landed okay on the Daenerys arc after, you know, the entire internet's been a week arguing about it. And your piece that was written a couple weeks ago that I've been retweeting because I feel like it was so prescient, kind of comparing her story to Gollum's in Lord of the Rings, where she is consumed and ultimately destroyed by this thing that she desires so badly, the Iron Throne instead of the Ring of Power. I feel like they were telling a story about how power is consuming and can corrupt. And Daenerys has obviously been this complicated messianic figure this entire time. And I think the fact that she's a woman made us not see that bad outcome for her as much, because you want to root for her more, like when you see her in the beginning kind of being, you know, captive with these Dothrakis. And I think they, as they built this story, like said it was a story about power and not about female power and wanted to tell it that way, which I don't think works. I don't think you can tell a story about a woman in power and not have there be complicated gender dynamics in it.
Right.
But I think her downfall is not because she's a woman in power, but because she's a, you know, she's got this inflated sense of her value as a hero. And it doesn't feel, I guess it is sexist because that's what the optics are, but I don't think they're saying something fundamentally about women in power. And I think Sansa really does a lot to counterbalance that. And so I feel okay about it in the end, but I understand obviously why people don't.
My issue has never really been with, you can't tell this story about a woman, you know, like, mm-hmm. I don't think this story is off limits for a woman. I think it's unfortunate that it came down to like these two, volatile women, queens,
Cersei in the episode,
Cersei and Daenerys. I think that's unfortunate. Like, if she'd been squaring off against, you know, like in the books, we think maybe it's going to be this character, this like young Griff character that's not even in the show. Like, maybe it's going to be him.
That's hilarious.
So, like, I know. It's like, I mean, a lot of book readers think Cersei dies way earlier in the books than she does in the show. But like, why would you bump off Lena Headey and like have her leave when she could stick around? You know, if it's Daenerys squaring off against like, a man in power who is tyrannical, like that takes some of the air out of it. You know what I mean? And, but my issue has never been with the story. It's with the execution of the story. So like I've made peace with it, but by the time we're in the finale and all this Daenerys stuff at the beginning of the finale, like that stuff all works for me. Like,
yeah, totally. Her single big scene, like everything she said to Jon in that scene, I was like, yeah, that is exactly what she would say.
Yeah, and her big speech too, like all of it was really great. And the, you know, obviously that killer shot of the dragon wings coming out behind her, like, and like, you know, it looked massive. That set where she's on the steps and King's Landing is like, the Red Keep is like ruins behind her. Yeah. It looked incredible. I thought that.
I mean, it looks like a Nazi rally, like very deliberately, I think.
Absolutely, intentionally, but like I was watching it. I mean, I got a new TV this week, but I was watching it and I just like a couple times at the beginning of the episode, I was just like, this looks great. I was like, this just looks
expensive.
This looks amazing. but I still have my objections on how we got here, and especially like reading these interviews that Amelia gave both to Entertainment Weekly and to The New Yorker, Sarah Larson at The New Yorker, where she talks about how, you know, she didn't know this is happening to Daenerys until she got her season 8 scripts.
I know.
You know? And I was just like, because they've known for a while, right?
Yeah.
So, like, I get not tipping your hand too early because you don't want to flavor her performance too much, maybe.
Yeah.
But I feel like they should have told her in season 7. Like, when Daenerys comes to Westeros, tell her then. Give her, like, a little bit more time to work on this, you know, and work on her emotions around it.
The surprise too much, I think.
Yeah.
And like, it's almost as if the season had been 10 episodes, they would have had more time to lay all this stuff out. Like,
it's almost if the last two seasons had been 10 episodes, we would have had a lot more. Yeah.
I saw someone, I think it was Alyssa Rosenberg at the Washington Post, like tweeting that like the decision to make these seasons too short will be like one of the worst in TV history. And like, I don't know, maybe. But I do think it didn't serve anything in the end.
Yeah, I'm unwilling to make like big proclamations about what Game of Thrones means right now. You know what I mean? Like, it feels way too early. That was sort of one of the most cheekily meta lines of the episode, right? Where someone asked Tyrion, if I think it's probably John or whatever, like, is this the right thing to do or whatever? And he's like, ask me again in 10 years.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And that's definitely the showrunners being like, did we do right? I don't know. Let's talk about it in a decade from now, you know, sort of thing. So, yeah. And, okay. Anything else that I liked or did not like in this episode? And then just like, I don't think that I have anything else specific to pull out, but I will say, like, this doesn't leave, well, I think the way in which these last few seasons were rushed sort of blunted my emotions around the end of Game of Thrones, in that, like, it was hard for me to get emotionally invested when I felt like a lot of narrative and character shortcuts were happening. And so then I was just like, it felt like folly to me to pour my emotions into characters that I felt like were behaving inconsistently, like, internally, right? And so I sort of stepped back from the end of Game of Thrones. Or maybe I just did it as, like, self-defense of, like, this big thing is ending.
Yeah, too much, yeah, too much work to do to get emotionally involved.
I don't know. Whatever it was, like, I my whole heart was not in this final season or this final episode. And so I'm not feeling like this earth-shattering, like, oh my god, Game of Thrones is over. But I'm also not left with, like, a really bad taste in my mouth, which I think some people feel like they are. This finale, you and I are, like, you know, mixed positive, kind of mostly positive on it.
Yeah.
And I'm just sort of like, all right, this is how it, like, as far as, like, a montage, let's check in with everyone goes, like, you know, the camera tracking the back of these various Starks as they take their, you know, steps into a new adventure.
So much.
It's good. I think it's good. So, yeah, you know, I don't, I've got a lot of issues with, I'd say, definitely the last two seasons, probably kind of the last four seasons of Game of Thrones, if I'm being honest with you. But
that's a real book reader take right there.
Yeah, it really is. But yeah, I think as much as they could stick the landing with, I guess, the info they had and the shortened schedule that they put on themselves, they stuck it as much as I think they possibly could have.
Yeah, I think I'm a real easy sell on series finales. Just like, as I was saying, like, I just like, you know, handing our characters over to their fates and, like, you know, having them look toward the future. I just like that feeling about it. Like, I feel, again, like, similarly to how I felt after the Lost finale, which I, like, get is problematic for various reasons. And Lost had the same problem, like, we're in its final seasons. It was like, what are you doing? But it ended on this note of, like, you know, waving goodbye to everybody, which I love. And I really love that Stark montage at the end and seeing where everyone turned up and, like, you know, the unexpected redemption for Tyrion, which makes it easy for me to just think less about, like, oh yeah, they could have done this. Like, I kind of wish I'd seen more of that. I do wish, and I told you this already, that they, that Brienne had started her own chapter in that dang book. It was such an easy thing to do. And I get that she's, like, modest and it's not, she's not all about, like, trumping up her own legacy, but it, like, just a nod to that would have made me feel better. Maybe that's my one big complaint.
Yeah, I mean, it, thankfully it wasn't her final moment, because her final moment is, like, getting on with the business of the Small Council and being cautioning voice on the Small Council. So, like, if that had been her last moment and it was all about Jaime, I would have been equally as frustrated as you and some other people on the internet. That is the one place where I allowed some emotions to seep in, maybe because of my Jaime feelings. But also, I thought Gwendolyn Christie just did a tremendous job with this dialogue-free, you know, this scene. She just had her face to work with, and she worked with it. So
And, like, if Sam and Brienne are going to be the people who, like, write the history of Westeros from now on, like, I feel like we're in good hands.
Yeah. All right. Katie, what is, like, the number one thing you're going to miss about Game of Thrones?
Oh my god! Like talking about something and knowing everyone else is talking about it, and, like, Sunday nights are insane, and we've been working together for years, like, staying up way too late on Sundays, you way later than me. But just the, like, everyone experiencing something at the same time, like, all that's left for that is award shows and sports, I guess, but that's not as much my thing. I guess that's, like, too meta, but I do really buy that Game of Thrones is the last giant show we're all going to talk about, at least in this way. And it feels like a real loss.
Yeah, it does. Yeah, no, it definitely does. It definitely does. And I mean, I you know, to not get too emotional about it, like, I'm hoping there is something that's going to come next that's going to feel not a show that is as big, but something else that will make this connection we all feel around this feel as important. It's interesting because an interview we did a couple weeks ago with Paul Fairfield, the sound designer, who was, trying to come to terms herself with some of the negative feedback to the episodes that she worked so hard on. Mm-hmm. And she's like, she came to this very zen place where she was just like, I think we just all need this. We all need to be able to like release steam. We all need to be yell about this fake kingdom somewhere. And we all need to like yell together about it, because the reality, like once this is over, then we have to turn our like attention back to the reality of like our own politics or whatever it is.
And that's,
like,
no, we do not. We have murder mysteries in Monterey to deal with instead.
Okay. All right. Let's focus on that instead. That sounds good. Though, I mean, you messaged me last night because like, you know, when we were like deep in the throes of it all last night, Scarlett Johansson and Colin Jost announced their engagement. You're like, oh, this Game of Thrones finale news dump. Which is like, you know, the kind of thing you say where you're like, when someone drops something when they hope no one's paying attention.
When someone fires their CEO.
Yeah. And I'm just saying, like, the Trump administration really, I don't know if maybe they did, but they really should have tried to get away with some, like, stuff this last 6 weeks when we were all, like, distracted by Westeros.
We just don't know what it was. We missed it.
Yeah. Yeah, maybe they just did get away with it. And I don't know. all right. Well, yeah, I agree with you. I will miss the conversation even well more than the show itself. This has been a huge part of my life professionally, and I've met so many amazing people covering the show. So, yeah, we did it. It's done.
Oh my God. I don't know if you get to feel the sense of accomplishment yet because you still have work to do, but I hope you feel accomplished. It's really been an amazing run, and yeah, but there's only better things to come in the future and maybe less exhausting, but please take a moment to pat yourself on the back.
Let us all pat ourselves on the back for getting through the end of Game of Thrones in one piece.
We all did it.
We all did it.
Oh, all I right, have one more thing I'm going to miss. I'm just going to miss Sir Davos. I just like him. I want him in my life. I'm glad that he's like the fact that he survived the entire series is almost surprising to me, but he's just this like unfailingly good and thoughtful character, and I'm happy for him.
He forgot he has a wife, and that's a problem for me, but
I also forgot he has a wife.
He has a wife and like other children that he didn't lose in the Blackwater that he just like forgot about once they decided they weren't important. So let's hope that Mariah Seaworth, his wife, is living it up at King's Landing.
Maybe she's like it. On the Iron Islands with a Yara, like in the like I just imagine it's like a lady colony for no reason. So hopefully they're happy together.
Absolutely. All right. Well. Happy travels to everyone, no matter where you might going with the Unsullied to the Isle of Noth, to the Lady Colony on Iron Islands, whatever your future holds. Okay, Katie, for people listening right now who have their finger hovering on the unsubscribe
button,
what should they do?
knock that sword out of your hand like John tried to do with Grey Worm and failed. Stick around. Still Watching is going to take 2 weeks off. Well-deserved 2 weeks off, I believe. And then Joanna and Rich will be back on June 9th with Big Little Lies Season 2, which honestly, woo! I fully expect to have as much drama as Game of Thrones.
If not more so.
I still can't really figure out even what it's going to be about other than a lot of people trying to keep a secret badly. But I'm really excited. Still Watching will obviously keep going. If Richard ever comes back from Europe, if he didn't marry Taryon Egerton while he was over there, he'll be back on it. So yeah, please stay tuned. Still Watching is wonderful. I'm really excited to listen to the Big Little Lies season. But also if you want to find me and Joanna, where can you find us, Joanna?
We're just kicking around vanityfair.com. You can find, Katie on Twitter at Katie Rich. You can find me on Twitter at Joe Wrote This. You can listen to Katie on the podcast Fighting the Worm. You can listen to both of us talking together on the podcast Little Gold Men. And yeah, other than that, you know, we're everywhere at all times, just like Bran. That's where we are.
Yeah, and on Little Gold Men this week too, we'll have a dispatch from Richard from Cannes. So you'll get a true Still Watching Little Gold Men crossover this week.
I love it. I love how many people like maybe got to hear you podcast for the first time on these last two episodes, and that makes me really happy because you were incredible at this.
I had multiple real life friends being like, oh, you're on my Game of Thrones podcast. I'm like, yeah, whoa, okay.
Like, yeah, I work at that company too.
I know. I've been part of that podcast since the beginning, and now you know. So hi, everybody.
Yeah, hello. All right, well, we did it. Bon voyage, everyone, and we will see you in Monterey in 2 weeks.
Want to stay up to date on the biggest stories in pop culture and entertainment? Then be sure to check out the TMZ podcast. I'm Charlie Cotton from TMZ, the TV show, and every day I'll sit down with a member of our news team to give exclusive breakdowns of the day's most talked about headlines, stories we break, and the stories you care about. So check out the TMZ podcast, Monday through Friday, and the other podcasts from the TMZ audio network like Last Days and TMZ Verified, available on all podcast platforms.
Hi, I'm Lale Arakoglu, host of Women Who Travel. Each story from our guests and listeners is totally unique and utterly personal. We love hearing about your first impressions when visiting someplace new.
My first trip to the Patagonia region was on the Argentine side. I couldn't believe the expansive territory. It's like being in Tibet. The emptiness and the harshness really, I found transformative.
Or a story told when safely back on dry land.
You know, things happened every single day. I ran out of gas on a jet ski in the middle of the ocean. And I was like, what if a sea creature comes to eat me? But then I'm delusional. I was like, I'll make friends with it and it won't eat me. And maybe I'll ride that back to shore.
That's how it works.
Yeah.
Join me, Lale Arakoglu, every week for more adventures on Women Who Travel, wherever you listen to your podcasts.